Bigfoot, Nessie, Chupacabra. Are these and other purported monsters the real deal? Or are they really not more than a fantasy of those who want to believe? We'll ask those questions on The Cryptid Report. Welcome to The Cryptid Report. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. Now, when we think of cryptids, Bigfoot, werewolves, other legendary creatures, typically we think about things like the Pacific Northwest or the Himalayas or something like that. But did you know? Now, my show comes out of the Midwest. I'm out of Ohio. I know people. I probably have fewer listeners in Ohio than any other state. A lot of people in California and New York and Texas and things. Maybe not as many in Ohio. But did you know that there are many monsters in the Midwest? And that's why we have two great guests to tackle that subject. They have a recent book out. It's called Monsters of the Midwest, True Tales of Bigfoot, Werewolves, and Other Legendary Creatures. And I'm talking about Jessica Freeberg and Natalie Fowler. Jessica is the founder of Ghost Stories, Inc. and has performed paranormal investigations at a variety of reportedly haunted locations. She has written YA fiction, middle grade narrative nonfiction, and short stories for children and adults. Jessica lives in Minnesota, as does our other guest, Natalie Fowler. She does freelance editorial work and writes her own stories. She is a staff editor for Fate magazine. Hi, Phyllis. And a paranormal investigator for Ghost Stories, Inc. Natalie also, as I said, lives in Minnesota. Jessica and Natalie, thank you for appearing on the program today.
Our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So I guess that is the big question. I mean, like I said in the intro, I think most people think of the Pacific Northwest and these great forests and all these different places with these, you know, incredible mountains and so forth. But there are monsters in the Midwest?
Quite a few, actually.
Now, in terms of what was your criteria, monsters of the Midwest, how did you guys define a monster? What was kind of the, I think there's something like 23 stories in here. How did you select the things that you wanted to put the spotlight on?
Well, we actually had quite a big list. We did some preliminary research for each state, and we went through and found some of the best legends that we could find. And then we sat together and worked through the list, and it was really easy. We wanted at least one or two monsters from each state that was included in our Midwest map. And we worked through the list together and decided which were the most exciting creatures to include. And then we split up the list according to who wanted to work on what. And that was actually a very interesting conversation. We were at a coffee shop in St. Paul, in downtown St. Paul. And I think it was a Sunday afternoon, and it was pretty quiet in there. There were a couple other groups in there working. One table was filled with lawyerly types, and they were doing some sort of research on something. And here we're sitting talking about our list of monsters. And as it got towards the end, it was actually really funny. It became sort of a bargaining moment. And there was one conversation in particular that went along the lines of, okay, fine, you can take the snake that eats the dead bodies out of coffins if I can have the ranch hand that got eaten by the vampire.
Hey, did you say they were lawyers? That kind of stuff should be very familiar territory to them.
Right. Actually, Natalie used to be a lawyer, and so...
Oh, uh-oh. I'm sorry.
I always joke she's a recovering attorney.
See, you got to watch what you say. You never know who's listening.
But the funny thing with that is Natalie is such a talented researcher because of her background in law. So we really approached this in a very research-based way and tried to use stories that we could find primary source support for, meaning that it was reported in local newspapers or it was on the news, those sort of things where we could actually find some tangible evidence that it wasn't just something we pulled off a blog.
Now, going into this, did you guys come from, and it may be different, you may kind of have different points of view, did you come forward as believers, figuring that many of these stories had something to them? Did you come to them from the perspective going in that, these are probably mostly urban legend and folklore? Where did you start this project at? And at the end of our discussion today, I'll ask you where you finished it up.
Well, I can say personally for myself, I approach them from just almost like a childlike perspective. That's my thing is, I love ghost stories. I love monster legends. And there's a piece of me that really doesn't care if they're true or not. I just find them so inspirational as a fiction writer. And so I love to read up on them. But the more that we dove into it, the more I realized that these are really credible people reporting these incidents. You know, it's the local banker. It's just, you know, your average Joe Blow down the street, the mailman delivering mail, seeing these creatures. And so it became a lot more credible to me, but I'm always open to believing whatever anyone tells me, because if you have a personal experience, who am I to say it didn't happen, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that. We do a campfire show that I've been doing for about 6 or 7 years, and it's based around people's stories of the supernatural. And that's kind of my perspective. I mean, if somebody says, I'm telling you what happened to me, who am I to say that they're lying or mistaken or whatever? So we take them at their word. What do you think, Natalie?
I'm a very logical thinker. So I was inspired to work on this because of the research aspect to it. Although the more you get into it, the more you realize that people really did see something. And also, you know, when you start looking at the list of cryptids, there were a lot of creatures not that long ago that were said to be legendary that have since made it onto the list of real animals. So I think it's great to explore the idea that there could be something out there that hasn't been discovered yet.
And I think all you have to do is look at the oceans. It seems like they're always finding something new in the ocean or something that they thought was extinct or those kind of things. On land, sometimes it can be a little bit more challenging, but still very tantalizing. Now, in terms of the types of creatures, I think, you know, there's been so much focus put on, quote, Bigfoot, that when someone says cryptid, automatically they think, oh, they're talking about Bigfoot, which obviously adds part of the picture, but not the whole picture. I mean, how broad was this survey? How many different kinds of monsters of the Midwest did you find?
It really ranges. I mean, obviously there are a lot of Bigfoot sightings, and we had to include some of those. I'm a big Bigfoot fan, but there were some other ones that were really fascinating. Like in Ohio, you said that's where you're at.
Yep.
The melonheads. Yeah. I've never heard of melonheads before, and that was really intriguing to me.
Yeah, that one's relatively close to my area where I live. I live in northeastern Ohio, so certainly up here.
That one's so fascinating. I was just going to say that one's so fascinating because it almost has a feeling of almost a ghosty type of feel to it, because the legend of them being children that were kind of operated or tortured on by this Dr. Crow and then them being sighted almost feels like a ghost story to me.
That's right. What about you, Natalie? What would you have to say about the different categories we find in this book?
You know, we live in Minnesota, so we've heard about Pepe and some of the water creatures, but I was really surprised by all the stuff that's flying around. I was really fascinated and intrigued by the Mothman stories.
Oh, yes. What was the criteria? I mean, how did you pick these stories? I mean, there's a lot of stories out there, a lot of probably urban legends out there, too. What made you say, yeah, this is one we want to put in the book? Now, I know it's partially you wanted to get one from every state, but what was like the clincher for you when you saw something in a story?
We really did take a research-based approach to this. So really, we were trying to find primary source support for everything that we included. So that means things like newspaper articles, a lot of these stories were reported in the newspapers going all the way back to the early 1900s. And we just wanted something a little more credible. We didn't want to include stories that, you know, your typical campfire stories that somebody might embellish on as they get told, so that every time you hear it, it's bigger and stranger and crazier. So we really wanted to go back to the source for a lot of these. And so, you know, that actually helped us quite a bit with limiting our list. In fact, there was even a really great story out of one of the Dakotas, I believe North Dakota, and it was a really fascinating story about some werewolves that attacked a town. And we got further into the research on that, and there was one point where I was even calling the anthropology department of the university because it had been reported that there was a dig where they had found these bones, and I could not find anything to support that in any way. So I ended up calling the school to say, do you have a doctor so-and-so working there? Did he ever do a a dig, and we were unable to confirm any of it. So we had to cut the story, which was too bad, but we really wanted to keep it as true as possible.
Now, I'm assuming that each of you has a favorite story in the book. Can you tell us a little bit, each one of you, about your favorite story in the book? You don't have to give it all away, but give us a flavor of it.
Well, I love any of the Bigfoot ones. I mean, I truly do love every story in this book. They're just so much fun. But one of my favorite ones is the Cohomo, the Coal Hollow Road Monster in Pekin, Illinois. And part of the reason I love that one so much is because there was a period of time in 1972 that the operators of the 911 station there actually received over 100 phone calls in one evening of various people throughout the area seeing these Bigfoot creatures. And the kind of fascinating piece of that story is that the very first person who reported seeing this monster was an 18-year-old boy named Randy, and he was out with his friends. And they later came out and said that they had sort of made this story up to freak out one of their buddies who was working the night shift at a gas station. But then once that idea got into everyone's head, people from all over the town started actually seeing these things, to the point that people who didn't even live in the area, that didn't know that these sightings were going on, were even seeing these creatures. So then it's almost like, do we actually manifest paranormal stuff by a collective thought or fear? I mean, it's just such a fascinating idea to me that that occurred like that.
Natalie?
I think one of my favorite stories is the Clawed Beast from Evansville, Indiana. That's a story about a woman. It's in the 50s and it's a really hot day. And this woman invites her friend along to go take her kids for a swim. So the group of them goes down to the river, and having grown up in the Midwest and visiting the river and swimming in lakes, it's not the same as swimming in a swimming pool. And so when you go in the water and you swim, you're always thinking about what else is in there with you. And this family goes for a swim, and she actually got attacked from underneath the water. Something was pulling on her and trying to bring her down under the water. And it was like a claw that grabbed onto her leg and yanked her down under the water. And she was terrified. And she was a strong swimmer, so she was able to get away. And they go running out of the water. And it turns out she's left with this imprint on her leg that was there for quite a while. She couldn't get rid of it. And the medics came to check her out. She was, you know, scratched up, but she was fine. And she survived and she was okay. But the interesting part of that story to me is that a few weeks later, after it happened, she gets a visit from on her porch. She gets a visitor from a very official department, which I think of as like the Men in Black, telling her not to talk about this incident anymore.
Ooh.
So, yeah, that was pretty exciting.
Now, you talked about the kind of this collective consciousness, the idea that we can generate these things, and we did not that long ago a session with David Weatherly, and he's done a lot of research on the idea of tulpas, the idea that you can actually, via thought, generate a being, and it could be a ghost, or it could be something else, or it could be a cryptid, or it could be any number of things. I mean, do both of you think that's what might be behind some of these reports?
You know, it makes me wonder, the stories like that, and I have to think there's a little something to that. I actually saw a documentary that was produced by Chad Gallick, who is a fellow Midwestern boy, and he does some cool research on just that sort of thing. And his documentary was sort of about how when the Mayan calendar was switching over and everyone kind of had this fear that the end of the world was coming, I don't know if it wasn't that long ago, but there started to be all of these reports in the news of strange things that were occurring, like birds dropping dead out of the sky by the hundreds in certain areas, waters turning red like blood, but we find out later it's like an algae thing. But there were all of these things that kind of led us to feel like, oh my gosh, maybe the end of the world is actually going to happen. And his documentary was all about trying to figure out how much of our collective conscience does create some of the incidences that we encounter. And I have to think there's a little something to that. But then I also think there probably are a lot of creatures out there that we just aren't 100% familiar with because they don't come out and hang out with us like a squirrel might. You know what I mean? So I think it's a combination of things.
And I think there's also definitely something to the power of suggestion. When you plant the image in someone's head about this is what I saw, and then it gets picked up and reported, and you've got that media phenomena, I think that then every time you turn around, you think that it's easy to think that you could be seeing the same thing. But some of these stories, while that was clearly happening to some extent, there were also reports of someone coming from out of town that hadn't heard about it who also saw it. So there's enough of that where, you know, there's still something going on, in my opinion.
One of the theories that's out there, and then some people believe it's a cop-out, but I want to get both of your opinions on it, is the idea, let's take Bigfoot, for example. Now, critics always say, well, why haven't we found a Bigfoot body or some kind of DNA evidence or hair or any number of things? And there are a certain percentage of people out there who believe that Bigfoot, for example, is not just another animal, but it's some kind of interdimensional traveler. What do you think about these cryptids possibly being interdimensional travelers?
I can totally buy into something like that personally. And also, you know, that it might be something sort of alien, maybe not from another dimension, but from another planet. Like I said, I'm very open to any of the possibilities.
And we're both paranormal investigators as well. And the more that we do that, the more I realize there's a lot going on that we just can't explain yet. I think that we're on the edge of understanding a lot of that. And I think that we just don't know it all yet. So there is room for a lot of theory like that.
Well, one thing that I think is interesting, if you look at Bigfoot, and this is more mid-Atlantic, not Midwest, but Stan Gordon has done a lot of work on Bigfoot and UFOs, the coincidence of sightings of Bigfoot and UFOs appear in the same area. Did you find anything like that with any of these tales of the monsters of the Midwest?
Well, actually, the story that I mentioned about the clawed beast from Indiana, that one, there was something about a UFO that had been sighted in the area about the same time. I don't have the research on that right now, but I do remember seeing something about that. And so it could have been related. That was an incident that very much could have been related to the UFO sighting.
What's the creepiest power that one of these cryptids has? And you can both have different answers if you do.
Oh, gosh, I don't know about powers, but I think the fact of them being so, some of them being so aggressive. There was one in particular that it was some sort of a creature that had like three legs, and it came to one kid's house. The kid was outside running around and catching fireflies or whatever on an early evening, and he came into the house and his shoe was shredded, because this creature had stepped on its feet and the claws had shredded his shoe. And then just down the road, their neighbors, the children were home alone, the parents were off at a PTO meeting or PTA meeting, whatever you call it. And when the parents came home, the children were frantic because there had been a creature actually trying to get in through the window. And when the parents got into the house, they heard a scratching on the door. The dad goes to the door and there is this creature standing at the door, scratching on the door. And so just that aggressiveness is kind of terrifying. It seems like a lot of them aren't super aggressive, but when they're actually trying to bust into your house, that's super creepy.
Has anybody actually ever gotten harmed?
And no, not in the research that I found that, but I mean, the one that Natalie just spoke about with the water creature grabbing her leg, I mean, it was pulling her under the water pretty aggressively. It seems like it was kind of trying to harm her, but she was able to get away.
Natalie, creepiest power or attribute of one of these creatures?
You know, I think one of the scariest stories that we came across was the vampire story from Nebraska. And I don't have it marked, but it was the story about a ranch hand who was out on a trail ride with his team. And he went away from the group and was attacked by a vampire type creature that had the superhuman strength that you've heard about. And it was clawing at him and ripping at his throat. And he was harmed. He was really hurt by this. And fortunately, his coworkers heard what was going on and they came and they were able to scare the thing away. and go after it. I don't think they were able to catch it, though. So that was a situation where something was definitely going on.
Why do you think we're so fascinated by the idea of these cryptid creatures? I mean, it's just something that people seem to be fascinated by. Why?
I think there's something really awesome about admitting that we don't know everything. Because as humans, we like to think we know a lot. And we also like to try to figure it out so that we do know everything. So I think there's just a fascination with the piece that it's really rather unexplainable. And there's some of us who just have this drive and this need to understand it and figure it out.
And I think along those same lines, it's human nature to be curious, and it's human nature to try to understand everything in the world around you. And when there's something that you can't quite explain, that just drives the curiosity and the need to figure it out even more.
One thing I like about the book, and you mentioned this, is that you look at some more historical accounts. And the thing is that, you know, in 2016, if somebody comes out and says, well, I've seen a Bigfoot, sometimes I think there tends to be a layer of skepticism because you have this layer of social media and cable TV shows and all the stuff on the paranormal, including my own podcasts. So I'm not innocent in this regard, but people are kind of amped up for these things. Whereas if you look at some of the old historic accounts that go to the 1800s or the early 1900s, you know, at that time, even radio as a mass media didn't exist. They just had basically newspapers. So to me, some of those are the most credible. Did you find that in your research in regards to historic sightings?
Absolutely. There's one story in particular, the story about the Mothman out of Van Meter, Iowa. That is very true. And it was really fun to see the old newspaper articles and watch as the story sort of got picked up and spread from further and further. And it became kind of a nationwide story eventually. And it was fun to watch how that unfolded. And it was a really good reminder that things used to be really slow. That information used to move really slow. So it was fun to see the comparison to today's world where you see something like that and there's a picture on, you can snap a picture with your smartphone and post it anywhere, and then everyone weighs in on whether or not it's true. So I think it was fun to watch. It was fun to see how some of those stories had to work harder to gain the national attention than it would today.
Yeah, and I think one of the cool things about like a book like this or a show like what you're doing, Jim, is that we sort of take the fear out of talking about it. Because if you have an experience like this and you kind of feel like maybe you're losing your mind and you're crazy, it's kind of refreshing to know that maybe you're not the only one who's had this sort of encounter. I think that's why we love to watch these ghost hunting shows and things, because a lot of people have had paranormal experiences. And I find when people find out what I do for a living, they're mostly intrigued and then share a personal experience they've had, but they probably don't talk about it with everyone else, you know? So we just kind of take that layer of kind of fear and embarrassment out of just having a candid conversation about this sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we've heard about Nessie many times, but this one caught my eye. Tell us about Bessie.
Bessie was a creature from, this is one of our oldest stories in the book, and it's from 1887. And this one was really fun because this was actually written up in the New York Times. So it was a newspaper article from the Times way back in the day. And it was about two French fishermen that were out fishing, and they came upon, as they were coming in from their day's work, they see this creature on the shore, and it's wiggling around, clearly still alive, trying to get back in the water. And they were in shock at this creature. And they were experienced fishermen. So they knew that what they were looking at wasn't something usual. And they knew it was about to die. And they wanted just to get help with whatever they were going to do with this creature. And they ran off. And of course, when they came back, it had wiggled into the water and gotten away. But they were able to find these dollar size scales laying on the beach that they were able to keep as a souvenir.
Now, that's another point I wanted to tell you about, like an article in the New York Times. One thing I mentioned is that we don't people back then weren't inundated with this stuff. So in some ways, their stories ring more of credibility sometimes. But on the other hand, how did the media treat it, particularly newspapers? Because it's my hunch that they actually were not joking about it all the time. And maybe they took this stuff a little more seriously. Am I right?
I think they absolutely took it more seriously. I think, you know, they didn't have the spread of information the way we do today. So they took a lot of their information from newspapers and they relied on that as a source a lot of the times. So I think they absolutely took it more credibly than we would today.
And they have so much, they had so much less technology and much less of an idea that they kind of knew everything that existed around them. So I think they were more open to the idea of there being creatures around them that they had never heard of or seen before.
Yeah, sometimes I think the more we think we know, the less we actually know. I mean, there's a certain, I think there's a certain amount of wisdom in saying, you know what, I don't understand everything. And that's kind of where I get into an argument with sometimes with conventional sciences. I think that there is this assumption of infallibility. And the truth is, science has done great things. For example, we're doing this show and I'll release it and people can listen to it all over the world. And that's very cool. And it wouldn't be possible without science. However, I think sometimes some people in science tend to think, well, we've got this all figured out and there's nothing new under the sun. And of course, there's no such thing as fill in the blank. And to which I would say, you know, DNA existed in 1900. But science of the time didn't have the ability, the techniques, the tools to quantify it, sequence the genome, and so forth. So my point is that, yes, science is great. I love science. Yay, science. But we don't know it all. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that.
And I don't think that we're meant to know it all. I think that's kind of the cool thing. As a very spiritual person, I believe that there is a higher power that kind of orchestrates the universe. And maybe that higher power sees that we are getting close to thinking we know everything. And so they drop in some sort of weird creature that we've never seen before just to keep it interesting.
That's interesting. What are some of the commonalities you see across? I mean, is it kind of like every state has their own similar sea monster to a, if they have, you know, the freshwater or something that will accommodate like Bessie, or everybody has their version of Bigfoot, or everybody, do you find that a lot?
Seems like they kind of, there were similar creatures that had different sort of names kind of based on where they'd been seen, but sort of like werewolf creatures or Bigfoot creatures or the more sort of alienish, what I would call alienish creatures. But they all kind of had a lot of commonalities, just they were in different regions and perceived in different ways. But yeah, definitely there were the same sort of water creatures that have a real prehistoric feel in multiple states. And so, yeah, it seems like there's some common creatures out there kind of all around us.
And I think the commonality that I saw in every single story in our book wasn't so much about the creatures, but the people reporting the creatures that they saw. Every single person in this book that we wrote about was absolutely convinced that they saw something that they couldn't explain. So that was the commonality for me, was the attitude of the people that were reporting these stories. And they were the respectable people in the community. They were your bankers and lawyers and hardworking people all reporting that they saw something, and the courage it took for them to come forward was really admirable.
Yeah. And there's one in particular, I think it was in Nebraska. I don't have it open in front of me, Natalie, so correct me if I'm wrong, but they actually formed a posse. They got together. This was back in the like late 1800s, I believe. They got together and they actually ordered equipment to try to capture a sea creature. Do you remember which one I'm talking about?
I remember it. Let me try to.
But it was so cool because it's in their town meeting notes that these men all got together and they're like, we're going to buy this. We're going to buy this net. We're going to buy a harpoon. We're going to capture this thing because it's ruining our business, is because people are afraid to come and go fishing or swimming here because this creature is terrorizing the community.
And that's so cool because that's actually people saying that, hey, we've got to do something about this. There's trouble in River City, you know, that kind
of thing. Yeah, I love a good posse, too. Whenever they form a posse, I think that's always a good
sign. The flaming torches come out.
That one was the Alkaleli Lake Monster, and I don't know if I said that right, but it's from Nebraska, and it was really funny. It was funny to see that in the meeting notes.
Now, the thing is that, and you kind of took the words out of my mouth, the thing that's interesting is these cases where, you know, so much of what we see and hear today in the media are people who are investigators, whether it's paranormal investigators or Bigfoot investigators, whatever. Nothing wrong with that. That's a great thing. But I love the stories, whether we're talking about UFOs or ghosts or cryptids, whatever it might be. I love the stories about people who are just doing whatever it is they do. Maybe they're on the job, maybe they're home, maybe they're driving, whatever the case may be. Maybe in this case, driving horses. and who just have something happen to them while they're in the process of normal life. In other words, they're not going out and looking for it. It kind of comes and finds them.
Right. I agree.
Exactly. There's actually a really good story that illustrates that perfectly. And that's our Beast of Bray Road story from Wisconsin. This guy was out and it was his job to go pick up the roadkill on the side of the road. And that's not a job that you think about anybody doing on a regular basis, but obviously it had to get done. And that was his job. And he was just making a stop to pick up a dead deer along the side of the road. And he ends up seeing this creature, and he did not want to go report this, but he was also worried that it would. He also felt that he had a duty to report it because he didn't want anyone to get hurt by it.
Yes, and those are the fascinating stories. So I asked you at the beginning, how did you kind of come into this? Like, what was your perspective? Is this stuff real? Is it just urban legend? How did this project impact you? Are you pretty much where you were in the beginning, or did it kind of change or evolve your beliefs on all of this?
I think I came into it incredibly open-minded and childlike in my approach and ability to believe. And I think I'm leaving it more educated, still completely open-minded and childlike, but also just with a greater appreciation for the people who come forward and talk about it. And also a greater appreciation for how little we actually truly know about everything around us. And I think that's pretty cool.
Absolutely. I think that you go in not sure whether to believe certain stories, but when you see the absolute conviction of the people telling these stories, that made me believe that there is something out there, and whatever it is, we can't fully understand it, and it inspires me to want to know more about it.
Well, one way to know more about it is to pick up this book, Monsters of the Midwest. So the important question, Natalie and Jessica, is where can we find it?
Well, you can find it at any Barnes & Noble if you want to go in and purchase it the old-fashioned way. You can order it online from Barnes & Noble or Amazon.
Very good. Well, it's been a lot of fun. And by the way, since we're at it, where can people find out more about all of your work? I know you each have individual websites.
We do. You can find our websites under our names. Mine is nataliefowler.com.
And mine is jessicafreeberg.com. We keep it simple.
I like it. And mine's jimherald.com. So we're all set.
Well, we're all dot coms.
That's right. That's right. That's good marketing. Get your .com of your name. A little bonus for everybody, a little marketing advice. Our guests today have been Jessica Freeberg and Natalie Fowler. The book is Monsters of the Midwest, True Tales of Bigfoot, Werewolves, and Other Legendary Creatures. Jessica and Natalie, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
And thank you for being a part of the Cryptid Report. Be careful out there. You might run into a beast. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.